This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
This is E.O. Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to the
Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network News.
Humanist Network News.
I ain't afraid of your Yahweh. I ain't afraid of your Allah. I ain't afraid of your Jesus. I'm afraid of what you do in the name of your God.
It's April 30th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. The topic of our program is humanism, which is a worldview based on reason, compassion, and creativity.
Now, Duncan, while I thoroughly enjoy hearing that definition of humanism show in and show out, I think maybe we should give our listeners a chance to tell us what they think humanism is.
I think you're right. I think in the effort of inclusiveness and interaction,
yeah,
we should encourage our listeners to call our toll-free listener comment line.
Absolutely.
Which is 1-866-659-1515, and share with our audience your definition of humanism.
We'll give bonus points for those definitions which are succinct.
That is, yes. Brevity is wit. Jess, why don't you tell our listeners what we have in store for them today?
Well, today we're going to hear from Greg Graffin, punk rock star, singer for the band Bad Religion. I'm pretty psyched.
Yeah, I'm actually pretty psyched that for today's program, for the first time ever, we're announcing that the Humanist Network News podcast is the official podcast now of the American Humanist Association.
That's right.
So we're going to welcome the AHA members with a little punk rock. The AHA is a national humanist organization based in Washington, D.C., with approximately 10,000 members and many local chapters. And we're going to be hearing from a local chapter of the AHA in a moment.
Just so the listeners of the AHA members know, previous shows are not necessarily...
Oh, yes. This is our 30th show, so happy anniversary, Jess.
Happy anniversary.
AHA is not responsible for any of the 29 programs that have preceded this one.
You mean like the one that we call the sex show? Like that one, Duncan?
Yeah, the one where we enacted an audio sex play.
Yep.
but seriously, listeners, from the AHA, if you're new to the show, visit humanistudies.org/podcast, and you can hear other programs. And the AHA will be putting our show up on their website soon as well. That's americanhumanist.org. And you can hear from Salman Rushdie,
who we got
to interview.
Julia Sweeney. E.O. Wilson.
Yeah, and also the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, as they're ironically called. the New Atheists, Sam Harris, Richard Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, and Daniel Dennett. So have fun perusing our archives.
As we mentioned, our featured guest today is Greg Graffin, lead singer and co-founder of the punk rock band Bad Religion. Now, Greg co-founded this band at the age of 15 in 1980. And our listeners might be pleasantly surprised to know that Greg also received a PhD in zoology from Cornell University, where he spends part of the year teaching while he's not teaching at UCLA.
This weekend, Greg Graffin was awarded the Lifetime Achievement in Culture and Humanism given by the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard University, which is a local chapter of the American Humanist Association. And this is the second time that the award has been given. Last year, Salman Rushdie was the recipient. But Greg Epstein, the humanist chaplain at Harvard, told me that this year in particular, the students really had a say in who they wanted to pick to give this award, and they chose Greg Graffin. So while I was at Harvard, I thought it would be only appropriate to find a student to interview Greg Graffin, and I found quite an impressive young man to do that interview.
But first, in order to properly prepare, pump you up for this interview, we thought we'd play some Bad Religion for you. So this is New Dark Ages from the album Maps of Hell.
Fire.
Greg Graffin, thank you so much for agreeing to speak with us today.
Thanks a lot. It's great to be here. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to your secular humanist audience.
And for our listeners, you may be able to pick up in the background some lovely music in the Memorial Chapel at Harvard, music that is slightly different than the music that Greg Graffin will be playing later on tonight. Greg, I have asked a student at Harvard if he would actually interview you for our program. This is Dan Robinson, who is a sophomore at Harvard and president of the Harvard Secular Society. Dan, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Duncan.
The reason why I asked Dan to do this interview is because the students were very involved in selecting you to receive this award tonight, and I'd like to hear from the students themselves as to why they chose you and what they want to talk with you about. So without any further ado, I will pass the mic to Dan.
Thanks, Duncan. Bad Religion, the name of this band, has been something that's been really at the forefront of my mind while we've been promoting this. It's something of a provocative name. How did it come about?
I think what's important to remember is that we started Bad Religion when we were only 15 years old. And at that stage in life, the word humanism and even the ideas of science were not very forefront in our minds. We were mostly interested in rabble-rousing and being rebellious. And so the term itself, Bad Religion, came about because we just wanted to make people angry at us, basically. And at that time, the right-wing Christian movement was getting stronger and stronger in America. And it was around 1980, and there were a lot of conservative televangelists on television. And we thought, what better target than that to call a bad religion? And then it dawned on us, even at a young age, that it's kind of an ironic name because we started to amass a following, and we thought we ourselves are kind of representative of a bad religion. So it ended up being a very appropriate name and something that, as we got older, we didn't have to shy away from because religion is such a eternal topic for conversation.
You've kind of implied that your music does have a message, and that's one of the reasons that we picked it. Do you think you are a message musician?
First, I must say that if you assume that there's a message in your music, it's a rather arrogant and kind of totalitarian way of sharing music, because you don't always have, well, I'd say you rarely have control when you're an artist over how your art is to be interpreted. And I've always maintained that when I'm writing a song, I have to let go of it the moment it leaves my head, because it's going to be heard by people and it's going to be interpreted by people from vastly different backgrounds. And how they interpret it is their own business. So if there is any message in it, at a young age, I recognized that whatever that message is going to be decoded in very different ways. And therefore, I had to ask myself, is it really worth assuming that this message is valid? So what I would say is our music has a lot of substance. I hope it has meaning. And yet how that is interpreted by people varies tremendously. Best case in point, we have a tremendous number of atheistic fans, but I'd say we have an equal number of piously religious fans. And it's something that I think is a heartwarming. It says our music reaches a lot of people, and that's always meant a lot to me and to my co-writer, Brett Gurwitz.
Now, do you think that this approach to music, you know, having the way you put it, substance, do you think this distinguishes you from other punk bands of your generation and of the previous generation?
I wouldn't say that it's easy to make substantial claims for some of the more popular punk songs. I mean, the Ramones' Hey Ho, Let's Go was one of the great punk songs of all time, but it wasn't that deeply substantial in a lyrical way. And yet, culturally, it had a lot of substance. So it's really hard to generalize. Once again, we're talking about art. What I think is that Bad Religion, when I'm talking about Bad Religion songs, I'm talking about the ideas of my co-writer Brett and myself. And our songs have always been thoughtful. We always put a lot of thought into them, and they're generally well-informed because Brett's a reader and a very intelligent person himself, and I've always informed my music of from the research and the reading that I've done in natural science. Now, we take that kind of substance and we try to make it into an artistic piece of music, and I can guarantee you that our music is going to have a lot of thought behind it. So that's, it sounds terrible to say that that's better than other bands out there, because I don't really believe that. Some bands maybe have songwriters that can just rattle something off freeform, and it can have just as much substance as our songs that take weeks and weeks to formulate.
Now, there are many other ways in which your band is different from other punk bands that have been, it's been grouped with. For example, your singing style, your presentation style, the lyrics and the kind of words that you use all differ very greatly from bands like The Clash and The Ramones and Sex Pistols. Do you think that's connected with your particular style of music, or is it something you do consciously?
Well, one thing I noticed very early on when I started the band as a singer, I didn't want to emulate other singers. I didn't want to try and sound like this guy or that guy. I just wanted to try and be myself. And because of that, I never had a pretentious style of singing that was unnatural. So my unique style just comes from probably mostly from my genes. My unique sound of my voice is different from other people just by the luck of the DNA.
The way you articulate your sounds, the way you try to make everything heard, is that an intentional action? Do you have to work very hard for that kind of effect?
I always looked at singing like speaking, and rhythmic speaking at that. So I've always had a good sense of rhythm and delivery. And because we wrote these lyrics that we felt had a lot of thought and meaning behind them, I always wanted to deliver them as clearly as possible.
Now, moving on to another track, many other people, having hit it big with a band like Bad Religion, would have given up on education at that time, but you chose to continue it on through a PhD and onto a prestigious teaching position. Now, why did you continue on with that kind of life after having been so successful in another track?
I guess this is a perception problem, because you might perceive it as me hitting it big with the band, but I never felt like we hit it big. I feel like Bad Religion is a really interesting monster, and it's accompanied me through most of my life. And it's something that's a part of me that has morphed into a larger and larger part of me, but it's never really, to me, felt like an explosion of fame or an explosion of notoriety or some kind of a massive career that is worth throwing away everything else I've worked for to pursue. And because of that, I've always believed two things. Number one, you can't give up on education. So that's why I always stayed in academia. But also, I recognize that my academia was what was fueling my motivation to do music. So it was the ideas that I thought were so interesting. I almost always approached Bad Religion as an academic pursuit, something that needed to be reworked constantly, and mostly in terms of ideas, try to rework the ideas into more interesting formulae so that you could share them with a larger group of people from more diverse backgrounds. So I guess I never felt that we had reached the goal or the explosion of popularity that you might think we did. I think there's still a lot of work to be done, and I'm never satisfied with last year's record.
Now, we are giving you a Lifetime Achievement Award, and as we mentioned earlier, Lifetime Achievement Awards typically aren't given to people as young as yourself, but we felt that in your life you'd achieved two careers of notable importance. Now, so where do you see yourself going, possibly with science, with music, and in any other fields you might be interested in?
Well, I think I really feel sort of continuing with this idea that Bad Religion's work isn't finished. What I mean by that is that my work isn't finished because even though the award recognizes a synthesis of music and science, I really want to elevate my academic work and make it entertaining to large groups of people on the same scale as my musical work. And that's a tall order, mostly because of the way entertainment is set up today. It's easier to reach huge numbers of people with music than it is with academic works. But I believe that the topic that I'm interested in, namely evolution, is interesting enough that it can reach huge numbers of people. And I think that my perspective on evolution is different enough that I can reformulate it in an interesting enough way, hopefully to make a splash in the field.
Please do tell us a little about your scientific work regarding evolution and also religious beliefs among scientists.
This is something that, like I said, hopefully in the next 5 years or so, I can publish a book on it. But let's just say that I've done my work on evolution and religion has led me to the recognition that the field of evolution, the scientists in evolution, are a lot more interested in the process of evolution than they are in describing the natural world. And this is very interesting to me because even though the general public wants an explanation of process, I don't think you're going to find it through the study of evolution. I don't think that the process that Darwin espoused is adequate to explain everything, namely his reliance on, and it's not just his, I should say after the evolutionary synthesis in the early 20th century, we were left with natural selection as the sole explainer of everything, as the sole mechanism to explain everything. And I just don't think it explains enough to adequately satisfy most people who observe nature. So my goal is a fresh perspective on the system without necessarily explaining the cause. And that's why a lot of evolutionists will deride my work. But I think not enough people are spending time talking about the interrelationships. They're much more interested in talking about the process of change, and they're not as interested in showing the pattern.
What in particular have you done? I know you have a project at Cornell about the religious beliefs among scientists. And what have been your most interesting findings with regard to that?
Well, that was a project I did solely for my dissertation, and there's a questionnaire on there. If anyone's interested in looking at it, you can go to CornellEvolutionProject.org, and that questionnaire was sent to the most prestigious evolutionists around the world, namely ones that were elected to national academies in their country. And I chose scientists from all over the world and asked them a bunch of questions about how evolution relates to religion. And what I found was that, as expected, most evolutionists are stark raving atheists, which is no surprise. Most naturalists, it'd be hard to be a naturalist and not be an atheist. However, a small percentage of them did claim to be religious. What's really interesting to me is that the evolutionists who claim to be atheists thought that evolution was compatible with the tenets of religion, even though they believed none of those tenets. So they have come a long way since the time of Charles Darwin, who thought there was no way to reconcile religion and evolution. But today, we have a new method of reconciling the two, and it's called sociobiology. And through natural selection, the evolutionists of today, by and large, think that religion is produced by evolution. So they've cleverly found a way to make religion subservient to evolution, saying we can't really understand religion unless we study evolution. And of course, this is highly offensive to most religious people.
Do you believe this and this kind of compatibility? And what do you label your particular religious beliefs yourself?
I'm not a compatibilist. I think there's really no compatibility between the tenets of evolution and the tenets of religion. I have no problem with someone who wants to believe the tenets of traditional religion, but I don't think it belongs in a discussion of the evolution of species. I feel that what I bill myself as is a naturalist. I don't bill myself as an atheist. Like I said before, it would be very strange to find a naturalist who wasn't an atheist, because as a naturalist, I basically am saying that there is a way to come to truth in this world, but it's got to be through observation, experiment, and verification. And that, of course, precludes almost all religious claims, because most people say, hey, man, I believe in God, and that's all that matters. I don't have to prove it to you. Well, then you're excluding me from your worldview, because I don't think that that's a very inclusive way to look at life. So most naturalists are atheistic because of that, because there's just no way to observe God in a verifiable way. And so by the same token, saying you're a naturalist is a very hopeful way to look at things, in my opinion, because it says we can agree on a system by which we can derive the truth. And it's an inclusive society, and it's a way that we don't have to bicker about whose God is better.
Now, your work and your music have been very influential, if you don't mind me saying, in spreading atheism, naturalism, and humanism among youth. Do you have any advice for secular student activists like myself and my fellow students for how to make free thought on these issues more appealing?
That's a tough question, because I've always taken my job as a communicator seriously, whether I'm singing or whether I'm lecturing. I like to believe that I'm doing an adequate job of relating ideas. But I don't think I'm a very good leader in the sense that I can tell people what I think they should do. And in that sense, I would probably fail miserably as a leader of the secular group, because I would probably just say, do what I did. Study evolution, study biology, study the natural sciences, go out there and study nature and see how it makes you feel, and then compare that to the stories that you've been told in your traditional religions and choose for yourself. And I don't think there's any I don't think there's any competition. I think that science does a better job of making you feel a part of something than religion. Because when I spend time in nature, all of the knowledge that I've gleaned from my science textbooks begins to make sense. I do feel like I have a place in this world. And, you know, maybe people who are religious and have learned all the stories of traditional religions feel that same connection. And if that's the case, we shouldn't criticize them for it. But I would just predict that they haven't been exposed to the other. And if they are exposed, I think it would make them feel even better.
Thank you, Greg Graffin. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks to both of you for having a wonderful conversation.
This is David Niosi of the American Humanist Association. You're listening to Humanist Network News, now the official podcast of the American Humanist Association.
I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
That song we just heard was Atheist Peace by Bad Religion from their album The Empire Strikes First.
And before the song, we were listening to an interview with Harvard sophomore Dan Robinson and Greg Graffin, lead singer of Bad Religion. I was really impressed with Dan Robinson. He was a really articulate student. I guess that's why he goes to Harvard.
I guess so. I was really impressed with Greg Graffin. I mean, talk about a punk rocker, but I never would have guessed from hearing him speak, right?
Yeah, pretty articulate punk rocker. Well, during the acceptance speech talk that he gave at the event after this interview, Greg Graffin had kind of a dual personality. He was kidding that when he was standing at the podium, he was Professor Greg Graffin, right. And he had his coat and tie on. And then, you know, sitting in the chair, he was the rocker. He actually was joking about how this was the first time he's ever performed with his top button buttoned. he did take his sport coat off.
That's pretty funny.
For it, yeah.
So I'm curious as to how the folks who are perhaps no longer students might have reacted.
Yeah, and I'm included in that. Yeah, I talked to a few old fogies there in the audience, and they were very pleasantly surprised. They were a little apprehensive about, you know, hearing punk rock, but of course Greg Graffin was unplugged during the performance.
Oh,
so
nice.
Yeah, they thought it was great. They really enjoyed it.
Awesome. And for those who couldn't be there.
Mm. Yeah, you can actually, the Cambridge Forum was there at the event recording the entire event. The lecture, the talking, and also the musical performances. That's going to be broadcast on the radio at a future date and available on their website, cambridgeforum.org. And we'll let you listeners know when that program is available for listening.
Nice. So what else, you know, you were in the audience for the whole presentation, right?
Yeah.
What was your experience like? Would you?
Oh, well, I should say that, you know, Graffin covered a lot of the issues that he talked with Dan about in our interview, But there was a Q&A afterwards, which was great. And one of the topics I thought was really interesting, one of the people in the audience asked, probably a student, asked mm-hmm. Graffin, what's your reaction to popular atheism? Which I think by that he meant, the books by Dawkins and Harris, but also just the recent attention in the media. Or at least this is how Graffin answered it. He said he's not going to knock anyone's ability to make a living off popularizing atheism. It's not his place, he said. But mm-hmm. he was concerned that trying to present atheism in the media is a dangerous route, because he thinks that these issues, what leads you to atheism, are really too complex to articulate in the soundbite nature of the media. I thought it was interesting, since one of my jobs at the Institute is to do media relations, and I've placed quite a few stories about humanism in the media. But I thought it was a well articulated, as always, thought by Graffin.
And so, did you actually get to catch up with any students about their reactions also?
Yes, I did. And here's one student. Let's play that right now.
Amanda Shapiro.
Amanda, can you tell me, what are your reactions to the Greg Graffin event tonight? Did you enjoy?
Yeah, I thought he was a really perfect pick for our second annual Lifetime Achievement Award in Cultural Humanism. I was kind of in the beginning stages of choosing the recipient, and I knew Bad Religion just as a cultural icon for the punk movement. And I knew that it had some associations with criticizing religion, but not being overbearing about it. And then when I found out that his academic passions matched his, cultural and musical pursuits, I was really excited, and I thought he was the perfect choice to follow Salman Rushdie. And his speech tonight and the songs he chose to give clearly reflected that we made a good choice.
What did you think about Greg Graffin being unplugged?
I thought it was great. It's clearly more friendly for the Memorial Church at Harvard. And I do enjoy his punk songs too, but it was also really great. I was sitting next to a bunch of high school students, I think, who were big followers of Bad Religion. And they were kind of nodding along, and they were getting used to the new tempo of the song, and they were still just rocking out to it despite the fact that it was acoustic. And I think it gave them a new appreciation for the lyrics, and it certainly did for me.
Well, thanks for speaking with me.
No problem. Thanks.
If you'd like to learn more about the punk rock band Bad Religion,
if you're a new fan,
that's right, check out their website, badreligion.com.
And to learn about the Humanist Chaplaincy at Harvard, which hosted this event featuring Greg Graffin, visit harvardhumanist.org. And now I think we should play a listener comment.
Hi, Jess. My name is David. I was wondering if either you or Duncan had discussed the possibility of paradises now. It's sort of a philosophy where paradise is now, and this could technically be the afterlife, and we are living forms of it. It's sort of a beyond simple way of going about the daily life, and it might be too simple for some people to consider, but I really love the idea of how paradise could be now, and the thing we're striving for is delaying us from achieving it here. So just wanted to get your viewpoints on that, and how we could start cleaning up this earth environmentally, and ending a lot of warring and over just imaginative thoughts that are basically invisible, and nobody can explain where everything here is, right here. So, anyway, let me know. Bye-bye.
Well, Jess, what do you think? Since our listener caller asked you, what do you think about paradise now as an idea?
Well, David, I really liked your idea of people sort of missing out on what's going on around them because they're too busy striving for something, be it the afterlife or, their goal. I personally am a fan of living, in the present moment and, making that your paradise. I like that. I also think that sometimes this could be your paradise right now that you're living in, but this could also be your hell that you're living in. Depends on what kind of life you choose to create for yourself. But I definitely think that it has the power to be, you know, what you make it. What do you think, Duncan?
Well, you know, Greg Graffin, actually, there's a Bad Religion song. I don't know the exact lyrics off the top of my head, but it's something like, would you give it all up now just to live again? And it's kind of that same point, like people striving for the afterlife, they kind of waste
at least their life. The
one life that we know you have.
Exactly.
Richard Dawkins said something also that I'm gonna paraphrase. I don't know exactly what it was, but he was talking about not being afraid of death because he was already dead for billions of years before he was born, and he'll just be dead again. But that brings me to the one point that David mentioned, which is like that this is the afterlife. You know, I don't really know about that. Maybe in the sense of I would go more with the Dawkins line. I don't necessarily think we're living in some kind of alternate reality or alternate universe where we're living again, but I guess I'll find out.
That's right.
I'd like to also say, though, one of our past guests, James Howard Kunstler, on a previous show, is a very famous social critic of the American landscape, and he's continually pointing out that he's talking about the human habitat and what a wreck we've made of our everyday environment. And because we have a method of development here in America and other parts of the world of suburban sprawl, auto-dependent sprawl, we're creating some of that hell on earth you're talking about, Jess. Mm-hmm. Kunstler says it used to be affordable housing was just organically emerged throughout the community. You'd live above a store or you'd live in a carriage house. And today, affordable housing is an artificial commodity.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It has to be deliberately thought of and constructed. And it's typically in an environment where you have to have a car in order to get anywhere. So that makes you even more poor.
Exactly.
So I read Paradise Regained in college. That wasn't that was definitely not paradise at the time I read that. But anyway, thank you for your comment, David.
Absolutely.
And
thank you.
Listeners, if you would like to share any of your thoughts with us, the toll-free listener comment line is, Jess, I can never remember what it is.
866-659-1515. You can also, when you call our listener comment line, please feel free to leave a question for Sweet Reason, our humanist advice columnist.
And don't forget to call up and leave your definition of humanism, which if we select you, we will play it at the beginning of our program instead of having me do it all the time. So, Jess, what are we going to do for the rest of the show here? We're going to have some dead air if we don't come up with something.
Well, Duncan, I was thinking if, you know, the listeners were we're looking for some more humanist music.
Okay, folks, we're just pretending to set this up impromptu. We were planning on this. I'm sorry, Jess, continue.
We've interviewed some other humanist musicians.
We have.
We interviewed folk singer Dar Williams at the New Humanism Conference last April. Mm-hmm. We also interviewed folk singer Holly Neer, who wrote the theme song for our show.
Yeah, that's right.
If
you're a new listener and you're wondering who penned that wonderful tune at the beginning, it's Holly Neer.
Yep, that was actually, Duncan, our first interview that we did.
It was. So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. All right, well, let's play that for our listeners. We're going to reach into the vault and pull one out from the past.
Holly Neer, our listeners to our podcast are very familiar with your song, I Ain't Afraid, because you generously donated the use of it for our theme music. And I wanted to ask you, what were you feeling at the time you wrote that song? Why did you write the song? And have your feelings changed recently?
I grew up in a family that really supported the idea of fascination over fear. And that sometimes there really is a reason to be afraid, but we always try on fascination first. And as far as I can tell, religion should be a way in which people gather together to honor the unknown, not the known. We gather together to be in a state of awe at the fact that we're spinning through space at an unimaginable rate of speed. It's the only planet we know of that has life on like this. And how did we get so that we let that lead to murder and to destruction and criticism and fighting? So that's my belief system, is the open door policy, and interested in all sorts of things. Not that there shouldn't be belief systems or spirituality or religion, but that none of those beliefs should be imposed on other people, and it should all be in a state of investigation. So, and community building and cultural building, but not a war zone. And I see in these times, and probably for thousands of years before, but this is when I'm alive, that that need for people to take sides around religion, to have everybody praying, or if you're not a Christian, or if you're not supporting this flag, or if you're not a Muslim and supporting that flag, or if you're not a Jew and supporting that flag, that we therefore are at a war with one another is just, to me, an absurd path to go down. But once you start the idea that my God is the right God and your God is the wrong God, and you get that feeling so strongly impounded into your brain as you're growing up, or in some sort of transformation where you feel like your life was so changed that now you're going to hold tight to this belief system, people over history have actually been talked into committing genocide in the name of their God, or destroying another culture. So the song came out of my wanting to say to people, it's not your God I have problems with. It's what you do in the name of that God.
You're well known as for your gay rights advocacy, but you also sort of take the step back and focus on the more broader human rights. And I just wanted to know, why is that important to you? Instead of focusing on one specific movement, why take the broader step back?
Well, I don't believe in causes. I think that we are holistic people. We have arms and legs. And if you only struggle for arms, you kind of leave your legs out of the picture. And so I've always felt like as I learned something else, when I first learned about wanting to be against war, and then I learned about feminism, and then I learned about gay and lesbian rights, and I learned about the environment, and I learned about immigration, and I learned about the prison system. And instead of running from one cause to another, I just keep putting that information into my toolbox as if I were in the university of life and I'm heading for a PhD. I just want to keep bringing it all into my library. And it makes me a more holistic, interesting person, and it makes me capable of appreciating other people better the more I know. And so folks who just focus on one thing, I mean, there are certain times when I think it's really important to take on an issue and put all, we only have so much energy, and put your energy into it. But gay people come in all colors. They come from all countries. And so you can't really be for gay rights and not think about what's happening to someone who's in Rwanda. I mean, how do you separate that? Are we only for gay rights of people who are in white, middle, upper middle class United States? Well, that's not a gay rights movement. And if you're working on racism, but you don't include gay people, then you only want freedom from racism for people who are heterosexuals? You know, I mean, you can't break us up into little pieces like that, much as people try. And I'm just unwilling to be chopped up into little pieces.
So that was our interview with Holly Near. What was that, October, Jess?
I believe so.
We were in like an alley.
Next
to St. Rose College. You know what I remember? We didn't say it's the first time we aired that, but do you remember we were holding this miniature digital recorder and microphone, and Holly Near was looking at the setup like, that's it?
Yeah.
And then she was like telling us how she was in, when she was in Vietnam as a journalist, I had to lug all this huge equipment around.
Yeah,
that was pretty cool. Well, Holly Near has quite the humanist message in her music. So if you're not familiar with her, or if you'd like to get reacquainted, visit hollynear.com for more information. Now, we pulled that one from our H&N vault, but I want to let listeners know that I have been salivating at the mouth thinking about the audio vault of the American Humanist Association, our new partners in this endeavor. They have quite an audio vault, Jess. Speakers like Carl Sagan and Isaac Asimov and
Kurt Vonnegut.
Yeah. So those are a lot of those. I think are. I understand they're on, you know, old like reel to reel tape and stuff. But maybe we can find a donor or find someone who's interested in helping us transfer those to digital so we can pull it from the vault on the Humanist Network News podcast. So
I love that.
Stay tuned for that.
Well, Duncan, that about wraps up our show for this month. Listeners, if you'd like to hear previous episodes, or you can also read show notes and transcripts for previous shows, visit our podcast webpage at humaniststudies.org/podcast.
And in the near future, all of that information will be available at americanhumanist.org as well.
And on during the weeks that we are not doing the podcast, Duncan is working tirelessly on the Humanist Network News e-zine.
With my editor, Ruth Geller, of course.
Oh, of course.
You can read our weekly e-zine at humanistnetworknews.org. We've got news, columns, features, cartoons, humanistnetworknews.org, folks.
Don't forget to ask our Sweet Reason humanist advice columnist a question, or give your definition for humanism, or...
or just let us know what you think about our program.
Call our toll-free listener comment line, 866-659-1515.
I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. We're going to take the show out with one last song by Bad Religion. This is God's Love from the album The Empire Strikes First.
And their record label is Epitaph Records. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Striking at mental apparitions like a drunk on a vacant street. Silently beset by the hands of time, indelicate in its fury. An aberrant crack is skeletons yield to unrelenting gravity. While viruses prop for helpless victims who succumb rapidly. Tell me where is the love in a Genesis creation? When there's no above, there's no justice, just a cause and a cure.
Humanist Network News is an audio production of the Institute for Humanist Studies, a nonprofit think tank that promotes the philosophy of humanism. Learn more at humaniststudies.org.